funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Riggy Ducournay, whose newest novel, Gazelle, has been published by Knopf. She's been a very loved guest on the program, and she has among her books a trilogy of novels, Entering Fire, The Fountains of Neptune, and The Jade Cabinet. Her short stories, or at least the first group of them, were gathered together in The Complete Butcher's Tale. She's the author of Phosphor in Dreamland, The Fanmaker's Inquisition. There is a book-length series of interconnected essays called The Monstrous and the Marvelous, which was published by City Lights. The Word Desire was an earlier book of short stories. And now Gazelle, which in many ways seems like the most, in certain ways, the most linear of the books so far. And yet it ends with a prediction, in a sense, that the book is meant to give birth to something non-linear. What it says is, nothing is more essential to living in the world than transformation. In other words, that this book is not itself, but what it transforms into and what it's transformed from, in a sense. And the book has in it the story of a young woman at age 13 spending a summer in Cairo in the 1950s when her father has a Fulbright scholarship. The book begins with a transformation, in a sense. It was a short story in the collection, The Word Desire, and it seems as if that story and this book have different intentions. One has flowered from the other, but in a new direction. And I wanted to talk to you both about the beginning and the sense of transformation that came with it.
Well, books are always, I think, about transformation one way or another. And indeed, this started off as a short story that I couldn't leave alone because it evoked my memory of Cairo as a child. I was there for a year. My father did have a Fulbright, and I was there for a year. And initially, I think I wanted to go back to extend that story because of my memory of Cairo, memory of a place that has really vanished. All cities are not what they were in the 1950s, and Cairo certainly has been totally transformed by cars and pollution and this vast population. So initially, I wished to evoke that vanished city, that vanished world, and my memories of that time. But then as I began to write, I realized that, more importantly, I was interested in the relationship with a father, and I think my own father. Unlike my other books, this one is autobiographical to the extent that the father is very much my father, who was a war game player and a chess player, as is the father in the book, and very eccentric and brilliant, but also sort of maddeningly difficult to reach. So that was the surprise for me, that the book began to take over, and I realized it was about the problem, I think, of betrayal. And betrayal is always about moral failure. And so the book is about the moral failure, not only of the mother, I think that's much more obvious in a way, but of the father, who is unwilling to engage the world and not really there for the daughter. And in that sense, he's very much like my father, who was brilliant and engaging and eccentric and a handsome Cuban, very smart, but also someone who was, like this one in the book, something of a dirigible. I mean, he was always a bit in space and hard to reach.
Well, what we discover about this character, about Elizabeth, is that after her 13th summer, She's gone for 13 more summers, and now she is back in Cairo, where she is narrating these past events. What we find out, among other things, is that somewhere along the line she's attempted suicide because a man leaving her notices the scars on her wrists and asks her why. She has devoted herself during that period, like the held Persephone, to the underworld, to the world of the dead, and to the anatomizing of mummies. And to some extent, she is going back to this 13th summer to unwrap it and to tell us what that corpse is like. It's her attempt, I think, to grow beyond it.
Exactly. And in terms of the suicide, in fact, she doesn't attempt suicide later. What the scars that she's talking about are the scars from that moment during the 13th summer.
When she made the tattoo?
When she needles the tattoo at the end, when she hurts herself by prodding until she bleeds the tattoo over and over again. So in fact, it goes back, those scars, and that was my reading, those scars go back to that moment, that summer, and her life is really saved by Baybars, the servant, who brings herbs to help heal her and cleanse the wound.
Now, she's surrounded by different kinds of men. I mean, specifically different kinds of men. Her father, who is known as to be an airhead by his students, and she also has near her a sensualist, a man named Ramses, who is a developer of perfumes, and in particular a bringer to life of the perfumes of the past, things that he's read about in Theophrastus and other works he's tried to create in actuality. There is a kind of earthy man who tells jokes, a Russian, that her father thinks that she's too young for. And there is the servant who is involved in healing. There's a young man in the shop who seems to be a certain kind of future, almost as if what we're doing is setting out the character at the center, and the other characters are parts of a tarot deck around her being put in position, the potential past, the actual past, what you've been dreaming of. Do you know what I mean? That life seems to be being laid out around her as a series of provocations and possibilities relating to her 13th year, where in Egypt she is regarded now as a woman, and the family which is preventing her from making those choices, while the culture she finds herself in is urging her to examine.
Hmm. I think that's a wonderful reading. I'm intrigued by the idea of the tarot because, of course, those figures are always emblematic figures and powers. And indeed, yeah, everyone she deals with is a power of sorts. I mean, they're all proposing various ways to perceive and to be in the world. And I also realized as I was writing the book, and this wasn't my purpose, but I think it came at a good time, that the most life-giving figures in the book were Egyptian men. And I thought that was an interesting thing at this particular time in terms of the political situation, that I had a number of Arab men who were nurturing. I was happy about that.
Her mother is a great white goddess. She's Icelandic, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And she chooses there in Egypt to dress in gold lamé and lemon linen and creates quite a stir, a kind of white blur wherever she goes. And it is in some ways that sense that the mother has been so rooted in the living body that it's almost as if this daughter has the dead body as her inheritance. This is what she feels she's been left.
Mm-hmm. I think it's tremendously difficult to enter into one's erotic life as a teenager when one has a blatantly sexual parent who's sort of taking up all the space and all the fantasy. And that's very much what her dilemma is a 13-year-old, is having this hyper-sexed and in many ways in-your-face sexual mother. And in that sense, too, the mother is, I think in some ways engaging because she's also so lively and hot, but she gives her daughter no room and is very insensitive to her needs as a developing erotic creature.
Now, these figures recur in your other books. Did working on the book alter the previous figures? For instance, there's often a wizard-like encyclopedist or curio collector man who is a paternal figure, but often less broken than the man here. In fact, he seems more capable in the earlier trilogy of still working magic, whereas in this book he invites magicians to create spells to cause the mother figure to come back to him, which she does hilariously, wondering why she's there, and leaves right away after breakfast. So much for magic. But in the other books, the magic does seem to inhere and work. I wondered about how this book and its somewhat autobiographical nature may have influenced earlier archetypes.
Well, first of all, I'd say about this book that it seems to me that one of the ways in which the father also is not up for being a father and is a tremendous intellectual disappointment to his daughter is that he does bring a magician in, and having brought her up to believe in rationality and in the importance of clear thinking, and when she expresses her dismay, she is ignored, and he, in bad faith, says, oh, but it's just a game, when in fact it's clear that he has become a bit soft and does want to believe in magic and is hoping beyond hope that it will work. So I just say, first of all, that it's very much, I think, an example of his bad faith and just another element in a personality which already has revealed itself to be dishonest. I mean, for example, the fact that he likes to change the rules of the games he plays or will pretend that he knows about something that he's never heard about before and is very agile and giving the impression that he knows, yes, I've heard about this before. And she's left confused. But looking back, well, for example, in the Jade Cabinet, the central character vanishes, the way the mother vanishes here. But the central character vanishes, Etheria vanishes, as a way of escaping from a bad marriage. She becomes a magician and literally volatilizes. Except that there, as here, the implication is it's not really magic. She doesn't really volatilize. She's just managed to escape, and by creating a marvelous magic act, she's able to support herself simply and move out of there. What else are you thinking about? I need to remember.
Well, I'm thinking of the cabinet makers and the insect collectors and the Lewis Carroll
figures. Oh, well, that's
figures.
True. Yeah. So, there again, the Jade Cabinet, it's true, the father is a very similar figure, and I'm certainly dealing with the problem of eccentric and fascinating and brilliant fathers who are not quite there for their daughters. And what happens in the Jade Cabinet is you have a father who is so interested in studying the language of Eden, coming upon the language of Eden, that he refuses to teach his daughter language, thinking that she'll take him there, that she'll she'll speak the language of the angels or the archangels, whatever. And, of course, it's very harmful. He also trades her in for a piece of precious jade. So you're right. I think there are these what are for me somewhat archetypal figures that appear again and again, and I want to investigate them in new ways. So the novels are different, and yet they are also troubling with similar problems. And one of those problems is the problem of betrayal and of moral weakness. And I like the word moral. I'd like to take it back from the bigots and right-wingers who have claimed it for their own, I think unfairly. The sort of self-righteous people have taken the word for themselves, but I think it's a serviceable word, so I take it back.
I'm speaking to Ricky Ducournay about her novel Gazelle, which was recently published by Alfred A. Knopf. Now, what I notice, though, is that these figures, they are often fascinating, eccentric, and charming, but they seem to be, this one seems to be the weakest, almost as if his obsessions have imprisoned him, provide the model for the imprisoning process. At one point, the girl is asked by the magician to be as quiet as a stone at the bottom of a well. And then later when she has the consciousness to point out, no, we're not a family of two, we're a family of three, suddenly her silence is not the thing she has to contribute anymore, and she's allowed to speak. Why? Because for the magician, three is half of six, which is his magic number, and so, you know, it moves along and along. She's given her liberty, but only as long as she fits into the numerological system of the next man who comes along. But it does seem as if, from being figures of tremendous evil, they've become more helpless, more powerless as they've gone along. Has this been the result of resolving certain things around this figure?
Not necessarily. What I'm thinking is that that this book, in a curious way, is, though it's its own animal, you know, and stands on its own 2 feet or 4 feet, it is also something of a beacon or illumination of the book to come, kind of way into the next book, so that if this book is about war games and about a certain lack of moral courage or clairvoyance, for example, the father's acceptance of an invitation from the CIA because he's so delighted to be perceived by anyone and so soothed narcissistically and takes this on, the next book is going to be about war and so about the real thing. And I imagine that I'll be dealing with characters, very very different sort, but I think inevitably with malefic figures once again. I'm going to be writing about Algeria. I thought that I would do 2 books about North Africa, this book, which takes place in Cairo, and then one about Algeria, where I lived for 2 years, right after the war, the Algerian war. The war with France, war for independence. I mean, I think there is a lot of magical thinking of all kinds, but that take place in situations of that are that lethal as justifications for really lethal action.
I wonder if you can make a set of distinctions for me that might be very difficult, because I've recently discovered, as I've been reading and rereading your books, that what we're calling magical thinking here are really the clouds that prevent the characters from understanding the actuality of their circumstances. Mm-hmm. They're what prevent the father from speaking very directly about Farouk's Egypt, or the mother from knowing who she's dating when she's dating Nasser. You know, that he's more than a gazelle. And I had been, to some extent, ensorcelled by some of the books into thinking of them as fantasy, when they are more, I'm coming to understand, about the danger of or the dispersion of fantasy. And yet they are enchanted. They mm-hmm. speak from within a system that is closer to myth and fairy tale than to political accuracy and realities.
Oh, so can Michael, you, can you're such a marvelous reader. Well, all those things are going on because I do believe in enchantment, and I do have a wonder room at home full of wondrous things, and I do believe in transforming the world and its terrors and banalities by living and thinking imaginatively, being as creative as one can. I think it takes a kind of constant clear thinking, actually, to be able to do that, you know, to see how the world can be transformed, made into a better place, a safer place, and so on. So I am interested in the place of enchantment in our lives, as I'm interested in the place of beauty in our lives. And I think that we make a tremendous mistake in this culture right now to think that enchantment and beauty are elitist somehow, when, in fact, reverie should belong to each and every one of us. I mean, we all need our forests and our tigers and our gardens and seas just roiling with fish of all shapes and sizes, you know. And all of this is beginning to disappear before our very eyes. But the world has been and can be and hopefully will be again a place of enchantment. So I'm a great believer in enchantment and transformation and the possibility of the transformation of the human soul that does get bogged down in all kinds of dreadful detours. But also there is this problem of magical thinking, which is a different thing entirely, and that is not being able to perceive the world with clarity and therefore the inability to make the correct choices, to make moral choices, to know how to behave in order to both protect those around you and yourself or liberate those around you and yourself. And that's an issue that does come up again and again because I think it's so profoundly important. All of us are beleaguered by and ruled by magical thinking of one kind or another. And the most prevalent and obvious is simply the idea that many of us are burdened with from infancy that we are bad. And that creates all kinds of structures that interfere with clairvoyance and living with depth and living with imagination, because of course one dares not embrace the world in profound and creative ways. One's stymied by this luggage.
This book seems to be really about the awakening of a young woman who has been variously encrystallated.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Know? And there are attempts on every side, in a sense, to have her, you know, it would be as awful to be her father's daughter as her mother's daughter, but pretty awful to be Ramses's girlfriend as well. You know, there's something where she's going to have to make a trip to the land of the dead, to her profession, which is examining the past in the forms of its deadness in order to escape her own deadness. You know, if deadness here is read as the ability of a set of ideas to imprison one or to hold one back or to keep one ensorcelled. She seems to have had a whole series of efreets and jinns who've worked their spells on her, and she is in a project of disenchantment, it
seems
to me.
That's right, and she has the good fortune, I think, to have had this lover, clear-speaking lover, who says, hey, you know, that what you're doing with the mummies, it's they're really just corpses. And when she says, yes, but corpses are safe, as a kind of joke, you know, corpses can't play any tricks. She's revealing an awful lot about her own terror. So, yeah, I mean, she's made this detour through hell, and a hell of her own choosing, by being an anatomist who's devoted herself to dead bodies, bodies that have been dead for 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, and at the end decides, you know, it's time I leave this behind. It's time I embrace the world. And in a way, it's interesting because there's a connection with my first novel, The Stain, which is a part of that tetralogy, actually. It's the first one. But there, too, it's a story of a young girl who comes into her own, and her awakening at the end is coming of age, recognizing who she is, recognizing that, well, she's probably a painter.
That's so interesting, because I always looked at that as a prelude book, and it was a trilogy, and then after book. That's so, it's interesting.
It's the earth book, and at some point when I was working on it, I thought, yes, and the next one will be fire. Because it is very earthbound, and it is all about sin, and it's a very kind of Manichaean book.
But can you describe, then, are these workings and reworkings of the imaginative materials? The books.
Yeah, I think they're distinct, each one, and yet they do also echo and mirror one another, so that there are the problems of determinisms of magical thinking in its various guises, the problem of unusual erotic vocabularies or interests, the problem of the end of Eden, how we are harming our planet beyond repair. You know, many, many themes reappear in new ways, and I'm conscious of that. So I don't want to repeat myself, but I do want to dig life deeper. I do want to, with each book, find other ways of dealing with this material. And of course, I always move on into new places as well. I mean, the books take over and take me where they will, which is part of the exhilaration and terror, I suppose, of writing a book. It has a life of its own. It starts breathing and stomping and whiffling down one's neck and growing horns.
Watch out. I've been talking with Ricky Ducournay, author most recently of Gazelle, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Thank you for coming again to the show and joining us.
Thank you so
much.
It's always such a delight, Michael.
I think so, too. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Bob.